Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined post-holiday by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic International Studies and Professor of Strategy Emeritus at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Elliot, I hope you had a restful and happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, lots of turkey and pecan pie. And unusually, we're not one of those families where you say Trump and people immediately kind of break into fights. That sort of thought. There was kind of a consensus. It wasn't a cheerful consensus, but so we kind of got past all that. But it was very good. And did you have a good holiday?
Yeah, it was lovely. It was very nice. We were down at our place on the Eastern Shore with our kids and grandkids and our granddog, at least for part of the time. So it was all good. But a lot happened, you know, while we were away, you know.
Well, we were each tackling a 20-pound turkey.
Some of it was creating a little bit of, you know, indigestion in my household. I mean, so we have a number of appointments, including in the national security area or adjacent areas. Some of them are, how can I say, more problematic than others. What's your take?
I need to confess that, you know, I am the one who said, well, you know, Marco Rubio is Secretary of State, Mike Waltz is National Security Advisor. Not terrible. I mean, kind of normal. But boom, then you get Pete Hegseth, Tulsi for defense, Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence. The unlamented Matt Gaetz for Attorney General, and now the truly execrable Kash Patel as Attorney General.
Or FBI Director.
Or FBI Director. What am I talking about? FBI Director, I'm sorry. Bad enough. And it's pretty bad, I have to say. I mean, I think the only very, very, very faint ray of light is that Keith Kellogg, the 80-year-old retired lieutenant general who served in Trump One, is apparently the designated envoy for Ukraine. And one of the things I did was to read a paper that he and Fred Feitz, who I guess had been the chief of staff of the NSC in Trump One, wrote about Ukraine. And it's basically, I mean, who knows if this is anything remotely like what they will do. The basic outlines are not terrible, all things considered. That is to say, that there would be a ceasefire, that it would not require that Ukraine acknowledge the loss of these lands, that there would be Western security guarantees, that there would be economic reconstruction, some sanctions relief on Russia, which is a problem, I think. But having said that, that that it's kind of backed by additional pressure on Russia, particularly through sanctions.
And more arms for Ukraine.
So all that sounds reasonable. The problems with that is, A, it's not clear to me that the Russians want that deal. I think that's not an adequate deal from Putin's point of view. I think he smells blood and he wants victory because as the senior diplomat from that part of the world told me the other day, he said, you know, when this thing is over, he said, I'm convinced that that's when Putin is in big domestic political trouble, given how catastrophic this has been for Russia. And secondly, the question is, what sort of leverage do we really have on Putin? Now, the one putting the most optimistic construction on it, there are additional arms you can provide, but I think secondary sanctions would increase the squeeze on a Russian economy that's already in trouble. And is striking with the Gazprom sanctions, and we finally sanctioned Gazprom, finally. Well, although not secondary sanctions yet, where you sanction the people who are dealing with it. But even so, I guess I still don't quite see the leverage, particularly in an environment which has gotten a lot darker because of the roles of North Korea, Iran, and China. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all relative, you know, given that we're talking about a Trump administration and fears that, you know, they're going to cut off, you know, Ukraine completely. The Kellogg flight plan was written in April, and the situation, you know, has changed. I mean, one piece of it that you did not mention was that Ukraine would be essentially, at least for some prolonged period of time, asked to give up its aspirations to become a NATO member, which, of course, is the most valuable and secure security guarantee for a post-war Ukraine. So it's pretty deficient on that ground.
Could I just respond to that? On the one hand, yes, and I think for sure there should never be anything that would exclude Ukraine from NATO. But the fact of the matter is, you know, Orban and probably Fico in Slovakia would be nixing this. It's a long process.
Erdogan
probably wouldn't go along with this. It's a long process anyway. The key to it, I think, and this is an idea I may try to populate, is we have to get the Europeans to be willing to deploy forces in Ukraine at scale. So like a full, you know, in my dream world, it would be like a full Polish division, a British-led division, which would probably include some of the Baltics and Nordics, a French-led division, which would include some of the other East Europeans. I don't know if you want to think about the Turks having a role, but I could imagine them being willing to deploy forces given their attitude towards the Russians in Crimea. I don't know, that maybe that's a bridge too far.
I don't think so. I mean, they've been asked about doing something in the Black Sea and have indicated they're not interested. I mean, the mechanism for doing what you suggest would be the Joint Expeditionary Force, which is this 10 country grouping of the UK, Nordics, and Baltics, and some Central Europeans like the Poles. And they're having a meeting in December, ministerial of that group. But I mean, what I'm concerned about is that, given the proclivities of the Trump administration and General Kellogg, whom I do not know, by the way, I never crossed paths with him when he was a commander of the 82nd Airborne, so I just don't know him. But by reputation, he's kind of isolationist in his outlook. The America First. I mean, the paper was written for the America First Institute. My fear is they're going to say, yeah, sure, fine, you Europeans do it. And the problem is, even with the Joint Expeditionary Force, which is these 10 countries that spend at least 2% of GDP on defense and are, you know, mostly all good NATO members and contributors, without the some U.S. skin in the game, and without the enablers that we provide, including space-based assets, which they don't have.
Missile defense.
I just don't see it happening, and I just don't see them doing it. I mean, David Kramer and I have a piece that I think will be out perhaps as soon as, you know, as soon as the time that this podcast will actually drop, that basically kind of is a kind of a missive to Trump and Kellogg. Well, Kellogg was appointed after we wrote this. That basically says, look, you know, if you pull the rug out from under Ukraine, you could end up having a catastrophic defeat of Ukraine by Russia, which would A, mar your administration, just, you know, essentially just as the Afghanistan withdrawal botched by Biden, you know, marred his administration in the first 6 months to a year. And that it would leave a huge crisis on your doorstep because the Russian appetite would only grow with that kind of victory. And that, you know, if you want a deal, it's all about leverage. And right now, the best leverage you have is U.S. weapons going to Ukraine, relieving them of restrictions that were put on the, you know, the Ukrainians by the Biden team. I mean, we should note that, I mean, it was Trump actually who did send, you know, javelins to Ukraine and during his time. So, you know, there is that. And you know, there is some hope that maybe, you know, Kellogg and others will kind of understand this. The Russian economy, as you said, is really in terrible shape. And if you can keep the Ukrainians kind of in the field for, you know, into, you know, the end of 2025, you might then get to the point where the Russians are ready to negotiate. I would say that, I mean, you know, one problem is that I think there is a sense, which I know the Biden people have been articulating and some of the kind of backbiting they've been doing and backgrounding of the press, but I think it's shared by the incoming Trump team that the Ukrainians are not doing enough for themselves, particularly on the manpower side. And there is enough truth in that. You know, if you saw today's Financial Times, a big article about desertions in Ukraine, some 60,000 troops have deserted. Now, not all of them have left. Some of them have gone back to fight, but it's a problem. And, you know, the conscription and manpower issues are real. I mean, part of the answer, of course, is to enable the Ukrainians to fight asymmetrically, as we discussed with Mick Ryan, but kind of there you have it.
So on the Ukrainians, I mean, I've always, first in general, I find the Biden administration truly distasteful in their criticism of the Ukrainians, given how badly they've treated them and their cowardice about supplying them. I mean, I think what you're looking at is this is a country that's been waging an extremely intense war in its own soil for 3 years. And what people forget is, in part because of all this nonsense about the greatest generation, World War II, you know, people try to avoid the draft during World War II, and people got exhausted. People, you know, we've romanticized what it's like at some level to be involved in a really big, intense war. And particularly one with no end in sight. You know, think about it this way. If at this point in World War II, if you want to think about it, we're just about to come up to the Battle of the Bulge, and then, you know, the war is over 6 months later. I think if you're Ukrainian, first, you think the war has been going on a lot longer than that, because go back to 2014, and you don't really see it coming to a definitive end the way you could and did in December of 44. So I think that criticism is unfair. On the other hand, you know, I think Trump will be driven by his desire to make a deal. And, you know, that I think we just have to accept that as a given. He will not. The Biden administration did make these sort of open-ended, you know, we're with you as long as it takes. That is just not going to be where he is. I think we have to accept that. I mean, that's his persona. It's one of the few definitive things you can say about his persona. No endless wars. He's going to make a deal. The nature of that deal, unfortunately, I think, and I deeply regret it, but I just think it's reality, is going to be some sort of ceasefire along the existing lines. And the challenge for everybody is to somehow help get the Trump administration to a place where you can make as good a deal as is possible. And that's why if I were a European leader, if I were Donald Tusk, for example, what I would do is, you know, try to lead the Europeans into saying no American soldiers on the front line. You know, no, we don't want any American, you know, armored brigades in Ukraine. We are not asking for that. I would emphasize that up front, and we are collectively going to put, and I would have it be a big number, like 100,000 troops into Ukraine. By the way, all we need from you is some missile defense, some space, some intelligence. That makes it a lot more palatable, I think, from the Trump point of view. You know, the deficiencies in the Kellogg flights document. And as I said, I was actually somewhat pleasantly surprised. I mean, they even approvingly quote Tim Snyder, God help him. I think they don't understand the depth of Putin's drive to restore the Russian Empire. Right. They think that the war can be brought to an end, whereas this would just be a pause for something else. And they, because they are, if not isolationist, people who are completely oriented to Asia, they don't understand Europe remains very, very important. And the consequences of this thing blowing up in the way that you said are enormous.
Including for Asia.
I think that's what we have to work on. But to be perfectly honest, and you and our listeners, I've been wrestling with wanting to write something. Because on the one hand, I don't want to do anything at all that would undermine the Ukrainian position. I believe in an ideal world, they would take every last scrap of territory back. But unfortunately, at this stage, I just don't think it's plausible. And I think we got to deal with the reality as it is. Am I being a defeatist?
No, we're in the business of, you know, making silk purses out of a sow's ear now. This is where we are.
Yeah.
The fantasy that the Russians are, you know, open, at least right now, you know, to negotiation, I think is one actually shared by not just the Trump people, but by the Biden people. I mean, that was the, you know, operational, you know, premise of their policy as well, right? And again, I think you might get there. I mean, the Russian economy is in such bad shape. The ruble is trading at all-time lows. You can't get people to make investments. There are major labor shortages. People, for God's sakes, they've got butter under lock and key at stores because the price of butter has gone so high that people are literally breaking into grocery stores to steal butter. So, you know, the Russian economy is not in great shape. Tony Barber actually has a terrific piece in the Financial Times today with a lot of charts and graphs, as the FT is wont to do, kind of laying all that out. But they're not at the breaking point yet. You know, you need more sanctions, and you need enforcement of, you know, some of the things that we have not done in terms of making it even harder for the Russians to pay for things. Maybe you can get there, but you know, we're not there yet. I don't want us to spend all our time on Ukraine because there's just so much else going on.
Yeah.
And other appointments. I think we've already talked about the Pete Hegseth appointment in past episodes, but the New Yorker article and the police report from the incident in 2017 in Monterey that was released last week before the Thanksgiving holiday, together paint a picture of someone with alcohol issues, someone with womanizing issues. And I say that because, of course, those issues were precisely the ones that sank the nomination of John Tower to be Secretary of Defense in 1989, when George H.W. Bush wanted to make Tower, who had been, by the way, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Yeah.
So someone clearly...
A clearly formidable character, let's remember.
Formidable character who was clearly qualified for the job.
Right.
But disqualified for these personal, you know, peccadilloes. I mean, I can't remember all the details, actually, of the Tower issues. But they seem to me, and maybe it's recency bias because I just read all this stuff about Hegseth, but it seems to me they pale in comparison.
Yeah, well, there's New Yorker profile, which really goes into that. And it's pretty disgusting, including him just getting roaring drunk and charging around, shouting, "Kill the Muslims, kill the Muslims." There's that. His position on women in the military. I wouldn't be surprised if he goes down. What strikes me about this is, with a number of these appointments, it's just clear that there's no serious vetting process.
Oh, God, yeah.
None.
Not at all.
None. This is Trump's whim. And he really doesn't give a damn. And it's partly because he doesn't understand, and it's partly because he doesn't care. And, you know, so you get minor things like, you know, his brother-in-law, Charles Kushner, convicted felon, you know, off to be ambassador to France. The French love that. Our former colleague Gerard Araud has been making some typically salty Gallic remarks.
But Gerard did say, well, at least he'll have access to Trump.
Well, that's how people think about it, by the way.
Right.
And then, you know, another brother-in-law who's going to be the advisor on Arab affairs.
But don't worry. He's got good ties to Frangia, who's the Hezbollah favored candidate for president of Lebanon. So that'll all be fine.
Yeah. But the, you know, Hegseth is, this is a disaster. We still don't really have the full story yet on Tulsi Gabbard. I'm sure that will all come out. I'm sure more is going to come out about Kash Patel. You know, it's as if they didn't fully understand that you're going to get both the Democrats and the press really doing the job that the FBI would normally do and would, you know, enable you to get warned off these characters. But I think they'll press. The only good news I see in all this, and that you can, again, tell me if I'm being wildly optimistic, is the Senate seems a bit more willing to exercise the consent part of advise and consent. Although how far they will go with that, I don't know. You're giving me that you poor naive.
No, I mean, look, I hope you're right. And, you know, certainly Murkowski and Susan Collins have said, we want to see FBI background investigations as we've seen, on all of, previous nominees. But, you know, this is not something that's in statute. This does fall into the sort of domain of the president's, purview, really, to, either get these FBI background checks or not. But as you say, they haven't been doing it. And it's, resulted in people being put forward who either have, more skeletons rattling around in their closets than one can shake a stick at, or, and or just not qualified. So we'll see, whether the Senate, enough members of the, Senate are actually willing to stand up and exercise their advise and consent role, and how many of them roll over for Donald Trump. I just don't know at this stage. I think most of them are hoping that these nominations die a borning because of what you just said, that the press will kill them by exposure of these things like the Jane Mayer profile of Hegseth. By the way, you didn't mention the emails from Hegseth's mother, which the New York Times got a hold of, which, accuse him while he was in the midst of divorcing his second wife to marry the woman who is his current wife, with whom he had already conceived a child while he was married to the second one, who he had done that with on the first wife. So the mother in the emails apparently accuses him of being a serial abuser of women. And, she's, of course, in retrospect, because she would like to see her son become Secretary of Defense, now said, well, it was the heat of the moment. I was being emotional. I didn't really mean it. It's not really true. But, problem with sending an email is once it goes off into the ether, it lives for eternity.
Yeah, well, that's a lesson to mothers everywhere. If no matter how angry you are at Junior, don't send an email. Signal, maybe, with disappearing messages. I don't know.
Or WhatsApp, yeah.
Yeah, or WhatsApp. Well, I don't really trust WhatsApp either. But no, it's we're joking about this, but it is appalling. One of the things, and you and I were talking before the show, and I think we'll want to do something separate on just this. The civil-military relations issues that the country will probably face will be enormous. If there's an attempt to sack a whole bunch of all of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that could happen. If there's an attempt to recall Mark Milley to active duty and court-martial him for uttering contemptuous words about the president, there's a very large array of use or abuse of the military along the border, or invocation of the Insurrection Act, against various blue states. I mean, there are lots of possibilities for a major abuse of power. One thing I found myself reflecting on, Eric, is there was I don't always agree with him, but David Brooks has had a number of, I think, very thoughtful articles. One of them is, look, part of what's going on here is a contest between the institutionalists and the wreckers. And you and I are institutionalists. And the problem is these guys have, MAGA world, let us say, has no understanding of, and certainly no respect for, institutions and no understanding of their value. And they don't understand that once you damage an institution, fixing it is really, really hard. And that applies to, you know, both organizational structures, but even norms. And by the way, I think talking about that kind of damage, Biden just did that by pardoning his son.
Of course.
It was, so, it was a shameful act and, violation of his promise to the American people. So, you know, now it's okay for every president to promiscuously pardon any member of his family who's finds himself in legal trouble. I mean, that's not the kind of country we are, I hope.
Yeah. It's hard to disagree with any of that. I mean, I think on the, you know, civil military relations, the only horrible thing you didn't mention was the potential of review boards to
plucking boards to pluck the
general flag officers who are too committed to diversity, you know, equality and inclusion, DEI, which is, you know, going to be very damaging to the force because we have a very diverse military. We have a very diverse force.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, look, do I think there have been excesses with regard to DEI? Absolutely. But, you know, we do have issues of babies and bathwater. The other issue, you know, that you raise about institutionalism is very important. And maybe there's some hope in the Senate for somebody like Mitch McConnell, who is no longer majority leader, but who looks likely to be the chairman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, which is not a small post in the Senate. It's pretty important, and is very much an institutionalist. And whether he will take a stand, that's, you know, one thing. The other is the sort of tech bros who are now playing a huge role in MAGA world. You know, notably, of course, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy as part of this sort of DOGE, you know, Department of Government Efficiency, whatever that is. It's not a government agency, but it's going to be two private citizens somehow cutting the government. You know, these guys come from a world that not only doesn't, you know, value institutions, it, you know, positively hates opposed them. To them.
Yes.
And, you know, their motto is move fast and break things. And so there's a deep anti-institutional bias there. And, you know, part of the, you know, thing here to me is that American people did not vote for this. I mean, the American people, you know, voted because they were concerned about the border. They were, you know, they thought the price of eggs was too high because of the inflation. They didn't trust the Democrats anymore and thought that they were too embroiled in a lot of cultural issues. But they didn't vote to have their government disassembled and dismantled.
Right. I think that's right. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day who is a former politician. He said, you know, he's just come to the conclusion that he's got a dark view. He said the American people are going to have to touch the hot stove. That is to say, they're really going to have to find out what happens when you elect these kinds of people, the kind of damage it does. I mean, the way it would probably be felt immediately would be, I would suspect, tariffs, if they actually do establish these tariffs. And then if they begin large-scale deportations with, you know, poorly planned, with, you know, some pretty awful scenes that kind of tear at the heartstrings, you know, that'll... A lot of people look around and say, "Yeah, you're right." And then I, you know, this is something we've talked about earlier. I do think, you know, the period of maximum danger is really the first year, because after that, you're going to have a whole bunch of congressional Republicans looking at the midterms and knowing that they could pay, and then, you know, and then people beginning to look beyond Trump. Because it is only a 4-year term, and he's, whether he thinks it or not, he really is a lame duck.
I
really don't think he's going to be able to break that that law. It's pretty clear cut, I believe.
Yeah. We could stay on this all day. There are a lot of things going on in the world that are being kind of occluded for the American people because of all this, you know, internal navel-gazing that we're doing. But there are a couple of important things going on in Europe that I want to talk about, and then we can maybe turn to Syria. So in Europe, we've just had a first round of a Romanian presidential election, which is very interesting in the sense that a populist kind of akin to Orban and Fico type has surged to the front. There were sufficient concerns about Russian interference, and we should note that Russia interfered enormously but failed recently in Moldova, right next door to, to Romania. But the interference in Romania was sufficient that the Romanian Supreme Court ordered a recount. It looks like they're not finding, you know, evidence of, you know, big, you know, cyber irregularities in the vote. And so there it will go to a runoff. The parliament will be controlled by the traditional parties. But there's a chance that in Romania we may end up with, you know, another sort of mini Putin, which will kind of strengthen that caucus inside NATO, which is a huge problem for the alliance now.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think there is, look, we haven't done this sort of really deep stepping back and saying, what does all this mean? I do think it's clear that there is this kind of general revulsion in the Western world, which is driven by a number of things, by the consequences of globalization and particularly the sucking away of manufacturing jobs to China, and a kind of thorough discrediting of the elites through the combination of the financial crisis and I would say COVID, and to some extent some of the wars that we've been and others have been engaged in.
You know, don't leave out of your litany a global trend of women increasingly entering the workforce and displacing men. That is absolutely a big driver of this.
Well, and also, you know, I think this we may have discussed before, you know, when I think about my grandparents' generation, if you came here with a willing heart and a strong back, you could, you know, work your way into the middle class. And that's no longer quite the world in which people find themselves by and large. So you have this, particularly the male working class. You have, I think, that a deep and very problematic separation between elites and, you know, the rest of the population, and that is reflected in the, you know, the astonishment of journalists from mainstream kinds of publications when they actually go out into the countryside. And this is not about wealth necessarily, but it has to do with education and all that. I think, you know, a general decline in, speaking of education, a general decline in education. You no longer have people who have populations who have great civic educations who in general are not all that educated, period, and have gotten kind of unmoored from a lot of the cultural grounding that we once had.
You know, the great, you know, mid-20th century American historian Richard Hofstadter, who wrote extensively about populism, attributed most of it to what he described as, you know, status anxiety, of displaced, you know, displaced groups in American society. He argues this was the case in the late, you know, 19th century and early 20th century. For him, it was the agent motive force, not only behind populism, but also the efflorescence of the progressive movement in the early 20th century as well. And I think you see that kind of, as you were just saying, globally. And it's creating this sort of populist wave. And, you know, the only thing that will be surprising is if we're not surprised somewhere else by this showing up in an election somewhere.
Yeah, I agree. Well, this is a larger topic, and maybe we should bring some deep thinker on to discuss it. But speaking of surprises, so in Syria, you've had...
Before we get to Syria, yeah. I want to stay in Europe for a second. I want to stay in Georgia, because Georgia is the one counterexample which is in Georgia, we're seeing in some ways a kind of not, you know, it's not perfect, but a bit of a replay of what we saw happen in Ukraine in 2014.
Right.
So
the population is just revolts against a corrupt Russian dominated, Russian manipulated government.
Government, which has now broken off negotiations with the EU. Where have I seen that in the movie before? Now, this is the prime minister in the case of Georgia, not the president, as was the case in Ukraine. But interestingly, the incumbent president of Georgia, Salome Zurabishvili, this is by a little, you know, footnote in history. Salome was I know her, she was a French Foreign Service officer.
Oh, really?
Stationed in the French embassy in Moscow at the same time that Trish and I were serving there. And she was, roughly speaking, it wasn't perfect, but she was roughly speaking my counterpart in the French embassy. And then, of course, when the Soviet Union broke up and many emigres from some of the Soviet republics went back to their home nations, she returned to Georgia, had her, you know, had Georgian citizenship reinstated, and ultimately became president of Georgia. And she is actually now calling into question the manipulated elections. She's saying she's not going to leave in January when her term of office ends. You've seen big demonstrations in the streets, very much like the demonstrations on the Maidan in 2013 and 14 in Ukraine. You've seen the Georgian riot police using heavy duty water cannons on these people. It's really quite a big uprising, and it is a kind of counter indication to many of the factors that you and I have been discussing in Europe so far today.
I just hope that the bad guys are not able to bring in the Russians to actually just like physically occupy the country.
Russians are a little bit stretched thin right now.
Which does connect us to Syria. I would say one other good thing, when, you know, because this has been a lot of doom and gloom. Kaya Kallas.
Typical for us.
Yeah, it is. Kaya Kallas, the former leader of Estonia, as the EU foreign policy.
Right.
I don't know what you call her. Director or something is
commissioner, is, I think, right?
Isn't yeah, she? Commissioner. I guess so. She's terrific, and
yes, she's great.
And she has made it very clear: EU foreign policy is going to be focused on Europe, and it's going to be focused on holding back the Russians and helping Ukraine and helping people like the Georgians. I mean, she is a leader of real stature.
She is,
and I just hope and pray that she'll be able to bring others along. I do think that, by the way, that this ties into what you were saying about the Joint Expeditionary Force. It's very clear that the Baltics and the Scandinavians, together with the Poles, and the Brits have their own problems because Labour is a total mess of a government in so many ways. They are really determined to do something to help Ukraine no matter what. And they are investing in the Ukrainian defense industry. They've been providing a lot more aid. Together, they provide more aid than set aside the Brits for the moment. The Baltics and the Scandinavians more than the Germans, I believe.
Oh, yeah. And per capita more than us.
Oh, and per capita, no question. So that's a good sign. And together with the Poles, who are truly formidable and are, of course, ready to fight if they have to.
Let us do turn to Syria now, though. So I know you've been chomping at the bit to get to it.
Well, I find it interesting. So basically, the story is that you have the Syrian opposition kind of bursting out of Idlib. This is in the northwestern part of Syria, and taking Aleppo, the second largest city, a famous ancient city, very badly damaged in the Syrian civil war, which it took Syrian government, I think, like years to take.
Within it only took it in 2016. Days. 5 years into the civil war.
And it's the opposition is led by HTS, which is an evolution of kind of a spin-off from Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, the Al-Nusra Front.
Yeah, the Al-Nusra Front, but it's not clear whether it's evolved in any fundamental way or whether this is all tactical. I mean, they say nice things about Druze and Christians instead of just slitting their throats.
They did break with Al-Qaeda in 2017.
Right. And I think they also sort of broke with ISIS. I mean, leader is this guy, Gilani, who is
right.
Seems actually quite adroit. These are nonetheless Islamists. So I guess there are a couple things that strike me about this story, and then I'd like to hear what you have to say. One is, I do think that the Gaza and above all the Lebanon wars have really kind of changed the geopolitics of that part of the world. And you can see that. I mean, Hezbollah has been really knocked on its back. They're not there to do the dirty work of the Syrian regime in the way that they were. You also see the fact that, you know, the Russians, who used to have a substantial military presence in Syria, you know, they've had to pull back because of Ukraine. So you see that all of kind of geopolitics interacting with its different parts interacting with each other. The other thing that struck me about it, though, which I think is something we always need to bear in mind when thinking about any war, I mean, the Syrian army clearly just suddenly collapsed. Now, maybe they'll be able to restore themselves. Syria is actually physically a big country. So it doesn't sound as though Damascus is about to fall. But, you know, we tend to forget that in wars, you can have major disjunctions when all of a sudden stuff that you didn't expect happens, and it happens in a big way, and it's dramatic, and everybody's trying to figure out what's going on. The third thing I'll say, and this is really, I think, in particular, I'd like to hear you pick up, what some of my friends who follow that part of the world more closely than I do have said is that they really think this was a Turkish operation, or, I mean, maybe not completely Turkish, but you know, with a great deal of Turkish support in terms of weapons, probably in terms of planning, probably in terms of intelligence. And this is part of the Turks wanting to resolve the Syrian civil war on their terms, get 3 million Syrian refugees out of Turkey.
4 million.
4 million. And, you know, exercise a kind of, at least, maybe not Ottoman-style control, but Ottoman-style influence over that country. What's your reaction to all this?
So a couple of points. One, before I get to my friends, the Turks, this is the Syrian civil war, which means there are no good guys in this story anymore. I mean, except perhaps the white helmets, you know, the sort of civil society groups who try to dig people out of, you know, rubble from bombing. There once upon a time might have been a hope for some good guys. That hope was unfortunately squandered in the Obama administration.
Absolutely. Number of ways in which it was a terrible administration.
Yeah, because they refused to actually do anything serious to support any kind of moderate opposition. And they failed to recognize that Putin's game was to basically destroy any moderate opposition and then pose the challenge of Assad versus the jihadists. And unfortunately, a lot of people in the West bought into that. So that's point one. Point two is that, yes, I mean, the Syrian army did melt away against this unexpected assault from multiple directions on Aleppo. There does seem to be some coordination now with the Kurds, the SDF, the forces that we've been supporting in eastern Syria, northeastern Syria, who have now moved down and took some of the area near the airport, and then they've moved back towards Manbij, which is where they've been, more or less the power in that direction. So that's true. But now the regime, you know, Assad, you know, was in Moscow when this started to happen, and then now is back. And they're, I mean, the Iranians are very weakened, and, you know, we've killed a lot, or the Israelis have killed, I should say, a lot of the Iranian officers who were holding all of this together. Because, you know, to go back to the beginning of this, right, after, in the immediate aftermath of the signing of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the late unlamented Qasem Soleimani went to Moscow and proposed to Putin that Iran and Russia together could save Assad, who was on his last legs. I mean, he was running out of people. He was on his last legs. The regime was ready to collapse. They didn't have the personnel to do this. And what Soleimani basically put together was, to the Russians, a proposition that if you give us the air cover, if you supply the air power and bomb the crap out of these guys, we'll provide, you know, the land power. We'll put together this kind of what I used to call an Abraham Lincoln Brigade of Shia militias. You know, it was Hezbollah, it was the IRGC, it was, you know, Afghan Shia, it was
some Iraqi Shia.
Iraqi Shia, you know, various, some Syrian groups. So it was this melange of forces. And that's what, you know, allowed Russia to intervene in September of 2015, support Assad, ultimately enabled him to take a year or so later Aleppo. And by the way, the bombing that went on then and now again, because now the Syrian and Russian air forces have been relentlessly bombing civilians in Aleppo, I have not heard the same sort of squeals of outrage about this, you know, that we have heard daily about what's been going on in Gaza, you know, unfortunately. And I think it's just a, you know, I just note that because I just, you know, think it speaks to the total hypocrisy with which the whole region treats, you know, conflicts like this.
The region, the way...
And we, yeah.
And the way American universities treat it. And, yeah, you know, and European...
Fair enough.
I mean, it is, yeah, it's hypocrisy. But
so to the Turks, like a lot of others, because the civil war has really been pretty quiet, you know, recently. I mean, the Russians, Iranians, and the Syrian government were able basically to beat back the opposition and pretty much isolate it to a group, you know, in Idlib province, which is on Turkey's border with Syria in the northwest, and these Kurdish pockets in the northeast. That was sort of the remnant of the civil war. And there was this kind of uneasy kind of stasis for a couple of years. A lot of countries, including ones that were trying to get Assad overthrown, like the Emiratis, like the Saudis, have been reaching out, they've been invited back into the Arab League. The Turks were also trying to normalize relations with Assad.
And Assad turned them down. I never.
The condition was that basically Erdogan wanted to get these 4 million refugees from Syria who've been living in you know, along the border in Turkey and all around Turkey, really. Many of them have, you know, kind of gone to other cities in Turkey. It's become a very big domestic political issue. And let's not forget that he had his biggest political reverse, you know, last spring in the municipal elections, where his party did very poorly, historically poorly, which does not augur well for his continued, you know, rule and his ability to pass his mantle onto one of his sons-in-law, which I think is what his end game is. And so basically this was the next Turkish play in, you know, failing to, you know, be able to find terms on which to normalize with Assad. Let me put it this way. They facilitated this. I don't think that, you know, that the opposition needed a whole lot of encouragement, but they did need, as you said, some training and some weapons and, you know, some planning. And I think the Turks have provided that. I think this has probably gone beyond already what they anticipated. And I'm not sure they're completely ready for what might come out of this. I mean, who knows? I guess I would say, you know, bearing in mind what I said at the outset, which is that there are no good guys in this, anything that's bad for the Iranians and the Russians and for Assad is probably good for us.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I mean, it has the feel of catastrophic success. As I don't know that it's catastrophic. I mean, I think the thing is it puts everybody in the region in a dilemma. You know, which bad guys do you want to root for? I mean, jihadists or Iranians? They're, you know, from the point of view of our friends, you know, Saudi, UAE, Israelis, they're both bad. Now there's, you know, there's the Kissinger solution, you know, that it's a pity that they can't both lose. What I wouldn't be surprised is if there's some people, you know, some actors who will be perfectly happy to feed this a bit in the hope that they both lose.
But there's a long American tradition of this. It's not just Henry. I mean, it's, you know, Harry Truman. Senator Harry Truman when
Hitler and Stalin.
Yeah, when Hitler invaded, you know, said, you know, we should support whoever is, you know, losing so that they, you know, bleed themselves white in the fields of Europe.
Yeah, that's, by the way, that, you know, that does, I have to say, just parenthetically on that one, the idea that Americans are kind of naive, you know, wandering around the world with lots of good intentions, but no, I don't think so.
No feel for real politique.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so, actually.
Right. I'm with you. Well, you know, we're about to wrap up, and it's actually a very good segue talking about Turkey and talking about refugees to mark the passing of a American diplomatic giant, I would say, the late Mort Abramowitz.
Yes.
He had a career that in some ways, as Donald Rumsfeld once pointed out to me, sort of kind of prefigured mine. He was a deputy assistant secretary of defense, a foreign service officer who went over to defense on detail as a deputy assistant secretary, later was ambassador to Turkey, and I followed in his footsteps. Mort was really a kind of restless force of nature in the foreign service, and he was a combination of both really great analytical rigor, which ultimately led George Shultz to make him Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research at the State Department, but also great moral passion. He was appointed ambassador to Thailand in the Carter administration, where he agitated relentlessly for relief for refugees from Cambodia, because he knew what about the genocide going on in Cambodia. And he worked very hard to force Washington to take this issue seriously and to do something for the refugees. And that became something that animated him really for, and his wife, Shepi, who passed earlier this year, for the rest of their lives. He was supposed to be ambassador to Indonesia in the Reagan administration. He got kind of, his nomination got sunk by a kind of right-wing smear campaign against him for being too focused on humanitarian assistance from his time in Thailand. You know, he'd been a China watcher in Hong Kong in the mid-60s. It was a kind of very interesting group of people who were there, the late Alan Romberg, the late Charlie Hill, and Mort was one of those people as well. Just a remarkable career. I mean, he went on to be, as I said, Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research, where he drew a lot of attention to the Anfal campaign, the Iraqi chemical weapons campaign against the Kurds. And also insisted on having serious intelligence community look at the Iraqi WMD program before Saddam invaded Kuwait. And then, of course, was ambassador to Turkey while Provide Comfort was going on, and negotiated very important agreements with President Özal that allowed the U.S. to draw on Turkish resources. Just a great American. I was privileged, actually, to not only know and see Mort as a role model in my foreign service days, but also then after we were both out of government, co-chairing a task force for a number of years with him about Turkey, and to co-author some op-eds with him about Turkey's descent into authoritarianism. And so it was really sad to see one giant,
I knew him only slightly, chiefly through his son, Mike Abramowitz, who's the head of Voice of America, who I've been close to for a long time. You know, the only thing I would add to that, that's a wonderful tribute. He was the son of immigrants. I think we sometimes have the mental image of diplomats as having double-barreled names with the third or the fourth after them, and impeccable Yale educations. I mean, we get some with Yale educations, I guess, now and again, and it doesn't do them too much damage. That was a pointed remark.
Thank you.
But you know, really, and somebody who had the kind of, love of the United States and a belief in the good that it can do, that I think particularly comes to the children of immigrants who have such a vivid appreciation of what the country means. And, it was a view of the United States as a force for good in the world with your eyes wide open. So it's not, this wasn't mush. This was very hard-headed, but it was truly patriotic diplomacy. God knows we need more of it.
By the way, one final thing I forgot to mention. He was one of the first to start agitating with George Shultz that the United States should supply the Mujahideen with Stingers if we really wanted to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. So, back again on the idea that, somehow woolly-headed American good intentions, are not somehow laced with, real politique.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. All right. Well, that's sort of an up note.
Well, about the best I can do for where we are in the world today.
All right. Well, to be continued, my friend.
All right.